Hello, everyone. Welcome to the final session in our Evolution in Banking and Payments webcasts. My name is Chris Reed. I'm the economist for Australia here at Morgan Stanley. In this session, we're very fortunate to hear from Michelle Bullock from the Reserve Bank of Australia. Michelle is the assistant governor in charge of the financial system at the RBA, and she's been in that role since 2016. As part of that role, she's responsible for the bank's work on financial stability, as well as the bank's oversight of the payment system. And as part of that, she is the deputy chair of the Payments Systems Board. So Michelle's talk today is going to centre on her payments responsibilities in line with the webcast's topic. It's obviously a fascinating time for payments, with the current crisis accelerating and in some cases disrupting long-standing trends. We've heard earlier this morning from James Fawcett, Morgan Stanley's US payments analyst, on some of the payments trends we're seeing globally and in the US. And Michelle today is going to give us a bit of insight on what we're seeing in Australia and potentially what we can expect going forward. I will flag that we'll be asking Michelle some questions after her presentation. You can submit these through the webcast portal if you have any you would like to be asked, and we'll do our best to get to them. And so with that, I might hand over to Michelle.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Chris, and thanks to Morgan Stanley for giving me this opportunity. I have to say this is not what I envisaged when I initially accepted this invitation at the end of last year, I'm willing to have a crack at anything, I think, at the moment. So we're living through quite extraordinary times at the moment. The COVID-19 pandemic is having dramatic effects on economies around the world. It's impacting employment, businesses and households. Monetary and fiscal policies have been heavily mobilised to help bridge the impact of the containment measures on economic activity. But the health crisis has also disrupted aspects of the retail payment system. Payment patterns changes have been large. There have been sudden shifts as merchants and consumers have changed both their payment preferences and their modes of interaction. Payment service providers have tried to accommodate these shifts in preferences in a very fast-changing environment. So today I want to address the potential implications of COVID-19 for the payment system. While we have until now been thinking about disruption to the payment system mostly in terms of entry of new technologically enabled service providers, the abrupt changes in payment preferences induced by the health crisis could in fact be a similarly disruptive force. And the extent to which it is going to depend on whether changes in behaviour are temporary or permanent. Today I'm going to discuss the potential payments policy implications of the changes we have seen during this period, if the changes we've seen during this period are a step change in payment preferences. So I'll start with some context on how the retail payment system has been evolving over recent years and the changes we've seen as a result of the COVID-19 crisis, and then I'll go on to discuss a number of policy issues arising from these changes. So over the past couple of decades, the way Australians make payments has followed a fairly consistent trend. So if you've got the first graph there, Chris. The main feature of this trend has been the decline in paper payment instruments, cash and cheques, and the rise of electronic payment instruments, as you can see in this graph, hopefully. Use of cheques has declined from around 50 per capita per year in the 1990s to around 2 per capita in 2019. As payments such as bills have increasingly moved electronic away from cheques. Use of cash for transactions has also been declining. The rise of cards, first credit cards and more recently debit cards, has been a consistent feature as well. Cards have increasingly been used in place of cheques for bill payments and cash at the point of sale. And cards were also an important enabler for online commerce, allowing payments to be made in a remote environment. In recent years, we've actually seen substantial innovation in the payments industry, which has furthered these trends and also widened payment options. So if we move on to the next graph, the introduction of contactless payments has made it quicker and easier to make low-value transactions by card, further eating into the traditional domain of cash transactions. The use of mobile devices like smartphones for payments has reinforced this trend. Now you don't even have to pull a card out of the wallet. Real-time person-to-person payments are now available using the new payments platform. Buy now, pay later options are widely available for online and point-of-sale purchases. There's also been plenty of discussion about potential disruptions to the payment space coming from big techs. So Amazon, Apple, Google, Facebook, and the Pays, Alipay and WeChat Pay. And then there are digital currencies, private sector or central bank issued. Although some of these newer methods of payments may not be extensively used, you can see from this graph that the consumers are increasingly aware of these various payment methods. But cash is still important. The increasing innovation in the payment system has resulted in substantial changes to the way we pay. Yet there's still a significant minority of the population that continue to use cash for face-to-face payments. So, next graph. Our most recent consumer payments survey was conducted late last year, and it showed that there were still around 25% of consumer payments undertaken using cash, accounting for around 10% of the value of transactions. And while a third of the third survey respondents did not use cash for any payments, around 10% used cash for all their payments. So cash users tended to be older or people on lower incomes. Enter COVID-19. Now, the anecdotal evidence suggests that there's been some behavioural change here. It's come from fast-changing consumer and merchant payment preferences, changing purchasing behaviour, and responses by payment service providers to facilitate change. Both merchants and consumers appear to have been keen to reduce their use of cash. Many merchants made it clear through signage that they preferred contactless card payment, even for low-value payments. Some even went as far as to indicate that they would not accept cash. Maybe partly in response to this and their own concerns about hygiene, many people reduced their use of cash in stores. In addition, there was a significant shift to online shopping where cash is simply not a payment option. As a result of these changes, ATM withdrawals in April were down 30% from the month before and over 40% lower than 12 months earlier. Payment providers have facilitated these moves. The transaction limit, below which a PIN is not required for a contactless card payment, was temporarily raised from $100 to $200 to further reduce the need to touch terminals. Banks promoted mobile payments, which because of biometric identification often don't require PINs, even for large purchases. And banks also obtained dispensation to mail out debit cards to a large number of their customers that didn't already have them. All of these changes are likely to have resulted in permanent shifts in behaviour, as some people maintain the new ways of doing things. People who've recently obtained a debit card for the first time now have the ability to use a card at the point of sale, as well as make online purchases. The increased use of online shopping, either through necessity or preference during the stay-at-home period, seems likely to be a permanent shift. In response, many retailers have increased their online offerings and may even find they can reduce their physical presence. There have been some calls for the no PIN limit to be maintained at the higher level, which would make point-of-sale card payments even easier. And mobile payments have probably received a permanent leg up. So we've been thinking about the policy implications of the changing payment system for some time. Many of the issues were raised in our consultation document on the review of retail payments regulation, which some of you might have seen. I'm going to focus on five issues here: the cost of electronic payments, technological lockout, resilience of the electronic payment system, access to cash, and the future of checks. So firstly, the cost of electronic payments. Now, the cost of payments to merchants is an issue that the bank has been focused on ever since it was given responsibility for efficiency and competition in the payment system in 1998, so it's a long-standing interest. From the early days of its work on interchange fees, the bank's been concerned with the way in which competition between payment systems works. In particular, since merchants are reluctant to refuse any payment method that consumers might present because they fear losing the sale, they typically take as many payment instruments as possible. And if a sufficient number of competitors take a payment method, it's very difficult for a merchant to refuse that payment mechanism. And the result of this is that they have limited ability to resist increases in the cost of taking payments. And as costs of payment rise, ultimately they find themselves in the prices charged to consumers. Now, while cash is not costless for merchants to accept, it does provide some competitive pressure on the cost of payments more broadly. So as cash use declines, it's even more important than ever that we ensure competitive pressure remains on the costs of electronic payments to merchants. There are a couple of ways in which this competitive pressure can manifest. The first is the use of surcharging. So merchants may not feel that they can refuse to accept a particular payment mechanism, but they may be prepared to signal to consumers that it's costly to them by imposing a surcharge for its use. And in fact, they may not even need to surcharge. In some cases, simply the threat of surcharging might be enough to negotiate a lower fee with the payment provider. And second, and particularly relevant for card payments, is what we call least cost routing. Least cost routing puts some power in the hands of merchants by providing them the ability to route a dual network debit card transaction through the network that costs them the least to accept. Now, in Australia, for many merchants, this is the FPOS network, so next graph. The evidence is that the growing availability of least cost routing has increased competition among card schemes through reductions in interchange fees, and this has resulted in a lower cost of acceptance for debit card payments for some merchants. But while least cost routing has been available for a couple of years, it has not been widely promoted by the major banks, which account for most of the acquiring market in Australia. So with many customers switching to contactless in response to COVID-19, some merchants are finding that their payment costs rise as the debit card payments that previously went through the FPOS network are now automatically routed through the international schemes. So it's therefore important that merchants be given the option of least cost routing. So far, the bank hasn't mandated that acquirers explicitly offer least cost routing to all their merchants, but it remains an option that we will be considering in the review. In the meantime, we're talking with merchants to understand their experience with payment costs through this period of COVID-19. We'll also be considering how transparency of the cost of payment plans offered to merchants could be improved. Ultimately, though, if market forces aren't generating competition to lower the cost of debit card payments, we may need to consider lowering the benchmark that serves as a cap on average interchange fees. On to technological lockout. So, least cost routing works because the physical cards being presented at the point of sale terminal are provisioned with two networks. They're so-called dual network debit cards. There's an international scheme and FPOS. But what if there isn't a physical card, as is the case with mobile payments? How do we encourage provisioning of dual networks in these circumstances and encourage the mobile and terminal technology to enable merchant choice of routing? There are, in fact, already some disputes in this area. Some banks have been choosing to provision only one debit system, so the option of being able to route is limited. And there are further disputes in the wings on scheme-dependent tokenisation of what we call card-on-file transactions and the problems this might create for least cost routing. As we highlighted in our consultation document, this is a very challenging area. But ultimately, if banks or other stakeholders are acting in ways that prevent downward pressure on merchant fees, we may need to consider regulatory options for keeping the cost of electronic payments low. What about resilience? So far during the COVID-19 period, the electronic payment system has had very few severe outages. And this is despite the need for many providers, the banks and so on, to be adopting very different ways of working, work from home arrangements and so on. Now, this is a very welcome outcome. Given the reduced use of cash during this period, it could have been even more difficult for merchants that were there to be disruptions to the electronic payment system. And in the circumstances, if there was a loss of access to funds, this could have caused more harm to customers and dented confidence in the community. But this episode does highlight something we've been concerned about for some time, the importance of the resilience of the retail payment system. There's effectively two parts to this. The resilience of the shared infrastructure, such as the payment card message and switching infrastructure, and the resilience of financial institutions' own systems. While there have occasionally been system infrastructure outages, most of the outages over the past few years have been in banks' systems. Sometimes it has been their account systems affecting the ability of customers to make payments. And sometimes it's been their merchant-facing systems so that merchants were unable to take payments. In these cases, often the only fallback at the point of sale is cash. Prior to COVID-19, there was already a sizeable proportion of people who tended to have little or no cash in their wallets. So when disruptions did happen, there were stories of people leaving goods at the counter or merchants effectively having to close until systems were restored. Post COVID-19, disruptions to electronic payment systems are likely to have a bigger impact. With some merchants discouraging the use of cash, we can expect fewer people to be carrying cash than before. The bank has already been working with the industry and APRA to develop a set of standard operational performance statistics to be disclosed by individual institutions. The proposed disclosures are intended to focus the minds of the bank's executives and directors and ensure that appropriate attention is paid to the reliability of their retail payment services. They'll also provide customers with transparency about the operational performance of different institutions. While this work is being delayed a bit by the competing operational priorities created by the current circumstances, it has become even more important. The work to enhance the reliability of the retail payment services provided by individual institutions must also be complemented by efforts to identify and mitigate risks of reliance on supporting infrastructure that can be single points of failure, and I think particularly here of telecommunications and energy sectors. While disruptions to these types of infrastructures have been more isolated than those at individual institutions over the past few years, they can have a major impact if they occur. As part of its strategic agenda, the Australian Payments Council is developing a framework for assessing and responding to these such system-wide risks. What about access to cash and the ATM system? So withdrawals of cash from ATMs have declined sharply over the past couple of months, as I mentioned. Next graph. Yep. ATM withdrawals have been on a downward trend decline for a number of years. But the decline seen in March and April was a substantial downward shift in the number of withdrawals. This no doubt reflects both a decrease in spending overall as people stayed at home, as well as a shift to other payment mechanisms, contactless cards and online shopping in particular. It seems likely that a large part of this will become a permanent change in behaviour. With cash withdrawals declining, there will be further pressure to consolidate ATM networks. In fact, the industry has already been considering this issue over the past couple of years. The changes induced by COVID-19, I think, will probably make this a little more urgent. I expect that there will be action on this issue a bit more quickly now. But there will still be some people who prefer to use cash. So consolidation of the ATM network will need to be managed in such a way that it does not disadvantage certain parts of the population that rely heavily on cash. Finally, is this suggesting the end of the check system? I think it may well be. Use of checks, next graph, Chris, has been on a steep decline for the past 20 years, both in terms of the number of checks written and the value. In April, the value of check payments was more than 40% lower than 12 months earlier, and this compares with annual rates of decline of around about 20% in previous months. The level of check usage has now fallen to such low levels that there is an active discussion about the future of the check system. Checks have always been a costly payment instrument. Estimates from our latest cost study in 2014 suggested that checks were around six times more costly than card payments in terms of resource costs per transaction. With the continuing decline in the number of checks being processed, the fixed costs of maintaining the system are becoming a more significant issue. One option that's being actively considered by the industry is closure of the check system. With electronic conveyancing increasingly the norm, a major use of financial institution checks is being phased out. And for bill payments, where checks are still sometimes used, there are many alternatives. But there has been a concern that there are some people for which there is no suitable alternative to payment using a check. They may not have reliable access to the internet to undertake online banking, for example, or they may not have a debit or a credit card. The changes associated with COVID-19 will provide an opportunity to reassess this. With social distancing affecting some branch services and the ability of people to get to branches, there has been a push by the banks to get people signed up to internet banking. Payment options such as BPAY and NPP will therefore be available to a wider range of people. As noted earlier, the banks have mailed out debit cards to customers, typically passbook holders who didn't have them, providing the option of online and in-person payments by card. It seems likely that these changes, which have happened much more quickly than they might otherwise have, will further reduce the use of checks and demonstrate to people that there are alternative and more efficient ways of making payments. This may bring the efficiency implications of maintaining the check system into even sharper focus. So in conclusion, the changes in payment preferences associated with the COVID-19 health crisis have given fresh prominence to a number of policy issues in the payment system. Some of the sharp and sudden shift to contactless and mobile payments and away from cash is likely to be permanent. It's therefore even more important that the costs of electronic payments are kept low and the electronic payment system is resilient. While it will be important to ensure that people who have traditionally used cash and checks are adequately catered for, the experiences over the past months has demonstrated that the shift to electronic is perhaps not as difficult as many would have thought. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Michelle. Very interesting presentation. And I think a lot of potential areas for discussion to follow on there. So, look, I'm going to kick off with some questions of my own to start off. But just as a reminder to those watching, you can submit questions through the webcast portal, and we do already have a few that have come through. Okay. So, look, Michelle, I thought I'd start with, you know, another of the RBA's payments focuses, which has been the NPP, mm-hmm. The new payments platform. How is adoption of that going? Have we seen any change in trends of that through this COVID crisis? And are we seeing any evidence yet of that's fostering, you know, innovation and new entrants into the sure. payment sphere?
Sure. It's a good question. And when I've been asked this in the past, I've often said I've been a little disappointed with at least the initial months of the NPP, because some of the banks were a little slow to get moving. I'm pleased to say that now the banks are all on board. And in fact, if you look at how we're tracking relative to use in fast payment systems around the world, for example, the Swedish, the UK, we're actually tracking per capita ahead of them. So we're seeing the take up as going very, very well. In terms of innovation, I think a few things. It's probably a bit early to see whether or not it's actually increased a lot of payments due to COVID-19. It may be that people have started to use it a little more to make payments to one another rather than using cash payments. But in terms of innovation, I think already we are seeing some firms starting to use the real-time payments capability to provide offerings, particularly to businesses who might be looking to receive payments in real time, and businesses who might want to be making payments in real time. The other area where we're starting to see take up is the government. And in fact, some of the payments that were emergency payments getting out to people have been made using the MPP. That's still an ongoing process of getting the government systems on board there, but that's all happening. So in addition to that, MPP itself is starting to do some innovative things. They've got some plans to bring on a consent and mandate service, which will allow effectively pull payments, so merchants to pull payments from people in real time. So there's a number of innovative things going on. I think the question will be whether or not in the operational challenges at the moment that many institutions are finding, whether some of these things get pushed a little bit back while they're dealing with the current operational challenges. But I think there's enough little lights on the hill there that people are starting to use the MPP for the sorts of purposes we were hoping they would.
Yeah, fantastic. And then I guess, you know, I think every discussion in payments has to touch on the new trend of buy now, pay later yes. schemes. So, you know, the reports that we've had out do suggest that there has been accelerated uses of those sort of schemes during this crisis. Obviously, some of that reflects the, you know, greater share of online. But do you think that there's also an element that those, you know, businesses are providing something that I guess traditional payment methods have not been to some degree?
Yeah, it's a good question and flavour of the moment. It clearly is filling a niche. There's something there that people are valuing in instalment. I should point out that instalment payments are not new. Instalment credit is not new. What the new technology is allowing people to do is access it in a much more friendly way. So yes, I think it is providing something that people are looking for. I think the online, you mentioned online, I think that is where it started. And I think the movement of people online has actually provided a bit of impetus to that. But as we know, it's also had some point of sale penetration as well. The interest that we have in it, and we've mentioned this in our consultation document, is no surcharge rules. And so there is a question that we've posed, which we've asked people to provide feedback on. Many point of sale merchants in particular have pointed out that although they're allowed to surcharge for debit and credit cards, for example, they are not, in terms of the rules of the buy now, pay later schemes, allowed to surcharge for those services. So we're having an active discussion with that about that with both the buy now, pay later schemes and the merchants. And that'll be something that will be ultimately coming to some conclusion on once we finalise the review.
Yeah, interesting. Might move to some of the audience questions here. We've got a interesting one here, you know, I guess looking at the PBOC's recent discussions about launching its own digital currency in coming months. Do you think central bank digital currencies will see adoption beyond China? And do you think there are, I guess, implications for the payment system there?
Sure. Yes, this topic keeps coming up. And Sweden and China's probably most far ahead, but Sweden also is reasonably advanced in thinking about central bank digital currencies. What we've said in the past about central bank digital currencies is that we don't feel there is a need for a retail central bank digital currency. Only around about 3% of sort of money out there, if you like, is central bank money, is cash. The rest of it is intermediated money. It's held in financial institutions. So we already have electronic money. So the question is, what what additional purpose is a central bank digital currency going to serve that electronic money from financial institutions is not already serving? And we're not really convinced that it does have a purpose in that way. Having said that, all central banks are looking at the issue actively. The Chinese, they have a sort of a different system over there in the sense that a lot of their electronic money, if you like, is in the pays, WeChat Pay and Alipay. It's effectively in a three-party system. So it's a little bit different to drawing money out of bank accounts like we tend to do in Australia. It's also true that in China that they, and this is the niche that the pays filled, is they didn't have as wide access to electronic payments as we had in Australia. So we've had electronic terminals in Australia practically universally for a long time. So the question, I guess, for many central banks, including ours, is what purpose does it serve? And I think that still we remain to be convinced that there is a purpose for a retail central bank digital currency that isn't actually served by something private sector money.
Oh, that makes sense. Another question here from the audience, I think potentially following up from one of our earlier sessions on the global payment side. One of the things that an earlier session flagged around the trends that Visa and MasterCard are flagging at this moment during this crisis is a lot more resilience and stronger recovery in debit cards over credit cards.
Yes.
Is that something we're seeing in Australia, do you know? And do you have any thoughts on why we might be seeing that divergence?
It is something, it's not just related to COVID though. We've been seeing this for some time in Australia as well. Credit card accounts are declining. The amount outstanding on credit cards is declining. Credit cards tend to be held by people, older people, people of higher incomes. Most younger people, and I can speak from the perspective of my own children here, they don't have credit cards and they don't want credit cards. They've got debit cards. So I think this has been a trend for some time, and we spoke earlier about buy now, pay later. Those that do want a little bit of credit might find that they have a debit card, and if they need credit, they can use a buy now installment sort of credit process. Why is this? I think possibly it reflects the fact that people that are borrowing on credit cards are paying an awful lot of money for it. They are very expensive interest rates. Those that pay them off on time, of course, don't pay anything. And people with higher incomes tend to be what we call transactors. That's what they do. But people that have been borrowing on credit cards were actually paying a lot of money for it. So I think what's happening is, and has been happening for some time, is that people are waking up to that. They're increasingly deciding to use their own money, possibly with buy now, pay later if they need some instalment credit. And credit cards are increasingly the domain of people that are paying them off rather than borrowing the money. That's not exclusive. That's a big generalisation, but that's a trend we've been seeing for some time.
So it'd be fair to say you'd see it as a trend that potentially is going to continue.
I would see it as a trend that's potentially continuing, yes.
Yeah, interesting. Look, just following up, I guess, on the commentary around the review into the payments regulations. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's now been pushed back to next year.
Yep.
Just wondering, you know, what about the disruption in the past couple of months? Is there going to be any change in, I guess, focus around that that review? I mean, you mentioned resiliency.
Yep.
In the payment system. I'm guessing that's probably going to be something that maybe has a more prominence. Are there any other areas that have, I guess, more or less focus, do you think, now?
I think at the margin, I mean, I don't think the issues that we'll be examining are changing. At the margin, there may be a little bit of a change in prominence. Certainly the cost of electronic payments and resilience were important, but I think they're more important now.
Mm-hmm.
The issues of buy now, pay later and surcharging, I think, will also be something that it was always on the radar, but it might be becoming more important. And depending on what happens with mobile payments and different form factors, if you like, for presenting cards, that might be marginally sort of a little more up the list. So won't change the topics, but I think emphasises some of them are even a bit more important even than they were when the trends were a little bit more slow moving.
Yeah, that makes sense. Fantastic. Well, we've just got one more audience question here that's talking around, I guess, cross-border payments. Mm-hmm. You know, what are the recent trends we're seeing there, particularly in terms of charges? You know, are we seeing any developments? What are you sort of expecting going forward?
So cross-border payments, I would have to say, is one of the most challenging areas in payments. And when I first started in payments in 1998, cross-border payments were on the radar. And I have to say, I'm pretty disappointed that we haven't made much more progress on that in many years. They still seem to be very expensive. And there have been some changes there, though. And again, technology is helping here as well. So there have been some new players come into the market here, which are offering much cheaper options than particularly the major banks. I expect that sort of thing to continue. Of course, there is the foray that Facebook through Libra are attempting to make into this area as well. So I'm reasonably confident that technology is going to help us here. I think because the traditional banking system through their correspondent banking arrangements hasn't managed to solve this problem. But I'm increasingly confident that there are new technologies and new players in here that are going to help make real-time or very close to real-time and cheaper cross-border payments. So it's not just the cost, it's actually the time it takes to get the payments anywhere. So I'm increasingly confident that there are changes going on in technology and new players that are going to help lower the costs and increase the speed of cross-border payments over the coming year.
Yeah, there's plenty of gains to be made.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Look, we're running up against the end of the time here now. So I think I'll bring this session to a close. I'd like to thank Michelle for a really interesting presentation and a pretty wide range of questions and topics. It's been very interesting. This is the end of our banking and payments webcast series for the morning. We will be back at 12:30 with a fireside chat with Atlassian. So we hope to see you there. We hope you have enjoyed the presentations this morning. Thank you again, Michelle. And we'll see you, everyone, back at 12:30. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.